session number 28898, reel 11.
Max Charles with reel 11. So, after this had occurred, Max, what was the next thing?
Well, I'm trying to remember when it was, but I was suddenly earmarked to go down to Massinghorn to fly Meteors. The first squadron of Meteors had been formed, and just missed the war because of whatever. But and I thought, well, okay, I'll go down and have, I don't know why me, but I've been picked to do it, so I'll go and do it. So it was just a one-off. I wasn't posted from the squadron. I was just going down to do a course on Meteors and come back again. And I was there, because the first Meteor only had 1,200 pounds of thrust from each engine. Now, when you think about it, that's, I mean, you know, the average jet fighter these days has sort of 22,000 pounds for each engine. So it was just trickle for. And of course, you can't have any dual an instructor with you in the aircraft. You just put it, the hood comes over and it's locked on you, and they say, well, get on with it. So I taxied around in the first Meteor. I thought, well, this is funny. You've got to open the throttle wide, and then very slowly start to trickle forward, and then put it back again, because it's producing thrust all the time. And anyway, I went round to the takeoff point on my very first flight and did all the, went through the checks, you know, made sure the jet pipe, you put the brakes fully on. Then check all your instruments, make sure the jet pipe temperature is at the right temperature, and all the pressure and all the things are right. Then you release the brakes and off you go. Well, it's full throttle. I didn't go off. I just started to trickle forward. And I thought, well, hang on, let's get going, come on, let's go. And I'd gone 200 yards down the runway, and I thought, I'm not going to make it, I'm not going to get airborne. I'm still only doing about 15 miles an hour. So I throttled back quickly and put the brakes on, and there's a perimeter track coming up, and I turned off, went back to the area where we were parked, and I called one of the instructors across and said, there's something wrong with the engines, they're not producing any thrust. He said, well, it feels like that, Max, but as long as your jet pipe temperatures are up and the revs are on, okay, reading okay, you're getting the thrust. He says, you might not think you're going to get airborne, but you will get airborne. Just keep going. So I went round again, but it was, compared to the Spitfire, on the throttle, you're airborne. So much power to weight. And of course, the propeller bites into the air and you get a quicker response. That's why flying formation jets is so much more difficult, because in a Spitfire you ease up on the other aircraft, and every movement of you throttle back and the propeller acts as a brake, and you come back and open, it bites the air again and you go forward. But in jets you've got to ease up gently against towards the fellow's wings. There's no way to put ease back on the throttle, or you overshoot and go past him. And there's different technique altogether. Anyway, I open the throttles. And I thought, well, okay, if he says it'll get airborne, I suppose it will. And it feels so different from being in a propeller-driven aircraft. You're sitting in the nose, there's nothing in front of you. The two engines just behind the wings. And I saw the end of the runway coming towards me. I thought, my God, I'm not going, I'm not going very fast. Try to get the nose wheel off, and it bounced back on again. And I tried to put it off, and it bounced back on again. And I thought, I'm not going to make this. I'm just not going to make it. I'm going to plow through the trees at the end. And eventually, I just eased it airborne. And I felt it was airborne, and I got the undercard up quickly because that's drag. But it climbed away so gently and gradually. And the first flight actually was a height climb, just to see how you handle it, and just gentle handling. It was so slow and so heavy and totally unlike anything else I'd ever flown. And coming into land, I thought, well, I better be careful of the throttle, because Spitfire just does a bit of throttle, it bites, you know, back and it comes back. Jet, you've got to just get it right from the way out and get the sort of thing set up properly. And when you touch down, throttle back immediately, because, as I said, the engines are still giving thrusts. And then you put the brakes on fairly quickly, but I thought, my God, if this is going to be our latest jet fighter, I'd rather go back on the Spitfires. But anyway, I did the course, finished the course there, and then went posted back to the old Spit squadron again. But then eventually the whole squadron was re-equipped with Meteors, but there's a Meteor 3 which had about, I think it was about 5,000 pounds of thrust in each engine. That was a very different kettle of fish. That really leapt off quite quickly and climbed quite well, and it was totally different. And then we went on to Meteor 8s, and they had more power again, and they were quite a good aeroplane. We learnt to fly Meteor 8s, to do all the aerobatics and things and fighter tactics that you have to do over jet. But it's a totally different aeroplane from a propeller driven aeroplane. The latest Spitfire flew was Spit 9, and it really was most responsive. If you try to take off full throttle, then the torque was so great that the aircraft would go to spin on its side against the propeller. So you had to ease the throttle forward with the aileron hard over to one side and the rudder on the other side. And as you gather the speed down the runway, put more and more throttle on, you could put the stick back to the middle again and take your foot off the rudder. And then you're airborne, and then of course you're opening wide up and you just climb away like mad. But it was when we got later jets, the Vampire was a beautiful aircraft to fly out, it was really lovely.
How did that differ from the Meteor?
Well, it was much smaller. It was just a very nice little aerobatic aeroplane. It had four cannons. You're sitting right in the nose, and it had two things going to the back, and a twin boom aircraft with a tail plane at the back, and that's why you couldn't bail out, because you get cut in half by the boom at the back. But it was a lovely little aeroplane, very manoeuvrable, very light, very glorious to fly. In fact, out in Haberdere, when we were posted out there, which was quite close to Baghdad, they still use it now. Using it now, I notice it's called Ramadi now. I formed a little aerobatic team, and I had about seven aircraft in this aerobatic team, which was so light and easy to fly and easy to formate with that it's just a lovely little aerobatic to fly. Didn't quite have the speed, but I remember when we were posted to Malta, we used to do a lot of exercises with the 6th Fleet, which was then a very powerful American fleet in the Mediterranean. They had a couple of three carriers and were very, very, very powerful. We used to do exercises with them. And one exercise one day, for example, was they were going to attack and take Malta Island. And our job was defensive. We had to defend against this. And as soon as their fleet was picked up on the radar on the ground, we were scrambled and we climbed up. Now, the Americans, they always had what was called a CAP.
Combat Air Patrol.
That's right, Combat Air Patrol. Flying around the fleet the whole time at about 30,000 feet in groups of four. And they just sat up there the whole time as fleet protection and lookouts, I suppose. And we climbed up. I thought, funny that. And I suddenly saw this fleet coming towards down there. Suddenly saw this group of CAP aircraft flying along in the opposite direction to us. I thought, it's funny, their radar hasn't picked us up. You know, they should be getting ready for combat and coming and attacking us. And we crept up behind them. And I said to my number 3 and 4, I said, look, I want to get right alongside this chap until he notices me. Because you can't dogfight with somebody who doesn't want to dogfight with you if he's just flying along. And they had canopies over the top too. American aircraft are built like armchairs. They are built around the pilot and his comfort, not like ours. And you see the canopies. I've got right alongside this chap with his stars on and coloured ladies and, you know, they're all macho looking things. This guy there with his big helmet and his dark goggles and all of that stuff. He was watching his leader. And I went right up in formation with him. And he suddenly just looked out quickly to his right. Perhaps his leader had said something. And he saw me there. And then suddenly it all broke into a big dogfight. Well, they started to race down towards the island. They were test of F-16s, or F, not F-16s, what I'm talking about. I forget what they call them now. They're, not F anything. Anyway, they were very sleek jets they had. And they were just slightly faster than we were. So when they got away from us, they went down towards water, and we just couldn't catch them in the dive. And but anyway, so we suddenly realised that the Vampire had a very low radar reflection. The radar is. I said to the pilots when we had dinner, we entertained him in the mess that night, and because they landed at Halfar in Malta, which was a naval base anyway, naval airfield, and we were actually based there, this naval airfield, and when they landed, we had some few drinks and dinner with them. I said, why didn't you get out after us so quickly? He said, we didn't know you were there. Radar didn't tell us there were any aircraft around. Your radar reflection is non-existent. I can believe it, because there's little wings, two booms, weren't big enough to be picked by their radar. So we had a lot of fun with them. But I remember this Banshees, I think they were called. I remember this, I was watching them taxiing in after they'd landed into Halfar. And this one taxi by, they had a hood up, and they all had their names written under their cockpits, you know, Lieutenant so and so and Captain so and so. And this guy was Lieutenant Commander UPSON Upson Downs, Downs. And that was his name. That, I said, what have you got him? I said, is that your real name? He said, yep, that's my real name. He said, I don't expect my parents ever thought I'd fly an aeroplane, but it really suits me, ups and downs. But they're great guys. Vampire's a great, lovely aeroplane.
What had happened in the chronology there? Because obviously once the war had ended and then the squadron converted to Meteors initially, was that while you were still in the UK?
Yes, well I left them. I left the RAF when I was still on Meteors. And then I rejoined again. I joined an auxiliary squadron, 601, called the Millionaire Squadron. I wasn't a millionaire. You had to join by invitation.
So when did you actually come out of the RAF? Was that
in 47?
So that was really the end of your initial service.
That's right. That's why I actually came out after since joining in 1940. But even then, when I came out, I joined this auxiliary squadron.
And would you do exercises with the auxiliary squadron? Was that what you were flying vampires when you went to?
That's right. And it was very funny actually, because I met several Pete Eddleston in a bar in London somewhere, and he'd been in a Spitfire squadron with me, and this my friend who'd also been a Spitfire pilot, Bob Large, and he said, hey, what do you for terror department? Said, oh, what do you do if I was doing there? He said, well, I'm not doing anything really, we're just sort of wondering what to do now out of the RAF. In fact, we were flying airplanes down at Hamble, we were flying Ansons about with navigators in the back to teach them how to navigate, or to fly the aircraft whilst they were navigating. It was a pretty humble sort of job. He said, well, we'd had a few drinks. He said, why don't you come and join us at the 601 squadron? I said, what's that all about? He said, well, it's an auxiliary squadron. He said, we're based north, North Weald, near Epping. And he said, we've got Vampire Ones there. He said, pretty nice. He said, but I'm afraid you have to be accepted by the squadron first, because we've got a big waiting list for people to get into the squadron. So I said, well, Pete, can you fix this? He said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, come down to a dining in night. We had lovely town headquarters, a really beautiful place. Prince Philip was our acting squadron commander. When he left, there was Sholto Douglas, who had been air marshal in charge of fighter command. They just sat at the head of the table, and we had a dining in night there. It was just no more than 18, 20 hours. Around the table, all the squadron silver, all down the front of the table there. And then we had squadron games always after dinner party. We drank an awful lot, and we had squadron games deep jumping over sofas and doing all sorts of things. And then, right at the very end, Pete Edmondson said, like, Paul Ritchie, who was our squadron commander, a very heavily decorated chap, he was an air correspondent for the Sunday Express at the time. Well, but both Express, Daily Express and Sunday Express. He had DSO and bar and DFC and two bars. He was tall, good-looking, blonde fighter pilot. He said, well, come meet Paul, I'm a squadron commander. So we went up to a little room, which was Paul's office. And we sat, he said, both of you sit down. And then they started talking to us, you know, about what we're going to do, and just generally sort of interviewed. It was an interview. It was whether we'd be selected or not, so it was a selection interview. And at the end, Paul got up, put his hand out, and said, would you care to join the squadron? We said, we'd love to, yeah. So we said, well, where are you? And we didn't know where they were based at the time. He said, we're out at North Weald, Epping. He said, come around. He said, we gather there on Friday or Saturday. We fly through till Sunday night, then we go back to our jobs during the week. So we said, well, okay. So we said, we'll try out next Friday. Meet us. Meet the planes and the other pilots. So we went up there on the Friday. And Bob and I were close friends, we did everything together. We went out there on the Friday, and there was nobody about. Actually, no pilots had arrived at all. Most of them arrived on Saturday because they were working until Friday. And there were two Vampires lined up, so I thought, oh, what if we could fly one of these Vampires? Never had seen one before. So I went up to the flight sergeant and said, are these Vampires service? He said, yes, sir, they're service. We're in civilian clothes. He said, oh, who are you? Yeah, so we just joined the squadron. He took our word for it. He said, yes, sir, he said, that's so as well. So we'd like to fly one. He said, well, okay, sir. He assumed, I suppose, that we were flown Vampires before or something. And because we didn't have identity cards or anything. And we could have been Russian agents, or could have been anybody. So just in sports jacket and... So I said, well, have you got a handbook? Every aircraft had its handbook, but looked like a car's handbook, you know, it tells you what to do, what revs to take off, everything, you know, how it works. And so we got in one. No helmet. Didn't have any helmet. So he said, you're going to be a bit noisy in there, you know, sir. So took your handkerchiefs off and stuff the ends in our ears to keep the noise out. He said, well, how do you start them? Well, oh, yes, I see. Where's that? Got things started. I think a cartridge started. I'm not sure. The bag and it started. And then, so we taxied round, feeling how it went. You know, taxied around the takeoff point. Up the throttle, took off, and it was great. Flying around in sports jackets. And we again and landed again. And that was different again to the land one. And because every aircraft has its own landing characteristics and takeoff characteristics and flight characteristics anyway, because it was in a single engine down the centre of this Vampire. And so landed, taxied back. I said, well, that's great. You have to flight. You have to sign a, if there's anything wrong, you sign a form for 700, which is a thing you sign before you take off to make the airframe and the. Everybody's done their job correctly and signed it off as being fit to fly. So you have to sign up before you take off and you sign it when you come back. And then we went round to the officer's mess and said we're in 601 squadron, so they gave us we shared a room we bought. Next day they all started to appear. And I said, well, we're going to show you around a Vampire, Max and Bob. So we flew on yesterday. What? I said, for Christ's sake, don't tell Paul that. Like, okay. Well, where did you get the equipment from? We didn't have any equipment. We just sat there with ears, handkerchiefs stuck in our ears, but we had a couple of lords on the squadron, and we had a couple of sirs. They're all terribly wealthy characters. In fact, Lord Pete. Lord Huntingfield's son. He eventually became Lord Mayor of London, proper Lord Mayor, not like old Livingstone, but the regal Lord Mayor. And he used to have he used to wear a nightgown with the great crest of his Lord on the front. He just poke fun at him. But he was a great chap. But anyway, we did that, and that's we flew the vampire. And eventually, I was fed up with my job. I was doing, I was selling hospital equipment and then ladies' dresses. I was not a bit interested in it at all. I wanted to get back to flying. In fact, I sat sitting for my exams for Boac pilot's license. They were very short of multi-jet pilots. And that you had a quick stream. If you're in the RAF and multi jets, you could take an exam, get your BAC, pilot's license, airline's license. And you could get fast track through and become a captain of a multi jet. And I was halfway through this when the Korean War broke out, and suddenly we started to expand the air services. Pay was doubled overnight, all the services, it literally was doubled overnight. So when I left the RAF in 47, I hadn't been given, very few people got permanent commissions unless they'd been in before the war. We had short service commissions, and you could extend it by another 4 years, another short service commission. And I thought, well, even though I'm married now, if I come out then, I've got to get a job. So I didn't accept the short service commission. Very few pilots did. But after being for a while in this 601 squadron, Paul Ritchie came out to me one day and said, "Max, why do you, you come around here Thursday, you start flying on a Thursday, you go till Tuesday, you spend all your time flying here, you get paid for it, you have a daily rate for it." And he said, why don't you rejoin the RAF? I said, "Well, I couldn't get a permanent commission." He said, "You'll get a permanent commission." So he signed both in, both Bob. No, Bob didn't. He didn't. I did. And so I got a permanent commission in the RAF. Was posted straight to a vampire squadron. No training. Well, I was pretty used to it. It was Vampire 5 squadron, which was a slightly more powerful engine. To have a ghost engine, which was 185 squadron, which moved immediately out to Malta, took the wife and Jeannie out there, and then we went to various bases in the Mediterranean, Cyprus, and eventually to Habanero, where we finished up, and in Iraq, which was bloody hot. Oh God, we used to fly from 7 in the morning till about midday, 12, because after that you couldn't breathe. You couldn't touch the aircraft, it was so hot. You'd burn yourself. You could put an egg on the wing, it would fry in 2 seconds. Even though we had great big parasols over them when they were standing up the side, still got just too hot to fly. And the air conditioner didn't come in until you were airborne, because it used to spin so fast. If you put it on before you got a thrust going through it, it would seize up. So you had to taxi out with the... And you're going out in formation, you're taxiing out, all crammed onto the end of the runway, the engine's going, blowing the sand and grit up, which was red hot, it used to sting it, ooh, and it hit you. And you just boil until you got airborne, and then you switched on the air conditioner, and oh, it was like heaven, snow used to come out of the air conditioner, it was beautiful. But so all your fluid was a sort of, you had briefs underneath, but just a flight suit. And a great friend of mine, still alive now, he actually. Waiting, he half fainted. He had a taxi off the runway, so the heat got him. But coming down through the Perspex top, when it was 120 degrees in the shade there, it was mighty hot, and you were really fighting for breath until you got airborne. But
did conditions vary in the air in that kind of?
Well, wherever you are in the world. 30 to 40,000 feet, it's always minus 60 degrees centigrade. So once you climb up, you start to get into the cool air.
Lower down, does the heat affect the conditions, though?
No, because we had this air conditioner, so once you got some speed on, you put the air conditioner in, and you could regulate the. Reasonably cool. They're very efficient air conditioners, actually.
But does the heat affect the performance of the aircraft at all? Yes, it
affects the thrust, because the air expands with heat, and so you take a slightly longer takeoff run. But it wasn't too noticeable. It's a real powerful 5,000-pound thrust engine goes, and you got airborne quite quickly. But so our job that was there was to we had rockets under the wings. It was a pass north of Mosul, where the mountain started, and they were frightened that if the Russians invaded there, they'd come down through that pass and sweep out into Iraq. And so our job was to, if they came through there, was to go out there and rocket them and knock out their tanks in these passes if they come through, and hope to block them up. Never came to it, in fact, but that was what our task was whilst we were out there.
How did you operate the rockets?
I'm trying to think now. I don't know. I think we probably had a special switch on the control column, but I just can't imagine. You fired them off separately, or you just fired them off altogether. That's 500 each wing, if I remember rightly. And they're quite good. You could get. We used to do a lot of air-to-ground firing, these rockets, practice firing out of the range. And you could get all 10 of them into a 10-foot target, a 10-meter target, white sheet, just length and angle, and fired into it.
Was there a different approach? Because obviously you mentioned lots of approaches earlier in the interview about how you would attack the V2 sites when you were dive bombing. What's the approach that you make when you're firing rockets?
Oh, I suppose we dived in at about a 40-degree angle. And that again, you used a gun sight, you just held it up. And we had a different sight there. It was a floating sight, which was much more advanced. And depending on the G, it worked out its own. I tell you about the amount of deflection you had to use. Well, it worked out its own deflection. If you had G, it pulled down. So that meant that when you put the dot on, you're putting the dot about there instead of on the aircraft. You kept it on the aircraft, but it compensated for it automatically when you pulled G. So that was great. And I think we used to just have it pull down till the dot was on the bottom of the ring or something, and fire from there.
And what about landing with the tricycle undercarriage? Because it's different, isn't it, from landing the Spitfire experience?
Well, all jets that we flew had tricycle undercarriages. That was quite different, because you landed on two wheels and waited for the nose wheel to drop. You know, you tried to do a three-pointer in conventional. Well, it wasn't conventional. It was conventional then, when you had two wheels at the front and one tail wheel. You always tried to do a three-pointer. In other words, land all three wheels together. But in a jet, you'd land on the main wheels and drop the nose wheel as soon as you could, then you could apply the brakes.
Was that difficult to adjust to start with, or was it? Because you'd been so used, hadn't you, to flying?
Yes, I suppose it was. Yes, there were jets were so different from propeller-driven aircraft anyway. It's a different type of flying altogether, different response to the throttles. And it was just different as tricycle undercarriage, which was different again. But we still got used to it.
Did you have a preference for jets or?
Well, after being, I mean, I've flown more jets when I left the RAF, because I went on to Canberra after that, and I was pretty used to jets. And I suppose jets were better. Really, we had bone domes on, so they were quiet. Engines were very reliable. But you only had two axles on a jet engine. You see, each end was. An impeller at the front of push the air in, cans which burnt the fuel, and a tailpipe which blew out this fuel which pushed it forward. And just two axles, and nothing to go wrong with them, a piece of cake.